This is the Medicast Live, recorded on February 9th, 2010, released today, February 15th, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic. I'm joined tonight by one of our most frequent and happy to have guests. I guess that's the one way you can say it. And that's Greg Fries. Greg has numerous excellent educational websites in the EMS and medical field, EPS411.com, EverydayEMSTips.com. And Greg's going to be joining us tonight talking about pediatric issues in EMS. And Greg, I want to welcome you officially to tonight's episode of the Medicast Live.
Hey, thanks, Jamie. Thanks for having me on. Happy to be here and looking forward to it.
And you just had an event that you hosted, I think, last night, talking about pediatric assessment specifically over at the EMS boot camp. How'd that go?
It went really well. It was myself and Jim Hoffman at EMSbootcamp.com, and we did a presentation about pediatric assessment, shared a lot of tips and experiences that we've had, and we just got a bunch of terrific questions from the audience, and it was a really enjoyable time. And, people can still access that lesson. We recorded it. It's available with a whole bunch of great premium items by going to EMSbootcamp.com and just clicking on the archives area.
Yeah, and I was supposed to help share in that that thing last night, and we got our dates mixed up, and I had to teach a bunch of firefighters and EMTs their EMS CPR recert. So I taught 27 people their CPR recert last night, so it was an interesting time.
Hey, speaking of CPR recerts, I have right on my desk here right in front of me, I just got this today, the Act Fast Anti-Choking Trainer. Have you heard of this?
You know, I saw it down at the EMS Expo, and I'll tell you, that's very intriguing. What's your impression of it?
Well, I'll tell you, I've seen the ads for it, and I saw it at the Expo, and I thought, well, who really needs this? You know, how much can benefit of training can be gained from this? So I pulled it out of the box this evening. I got it. I'm going to be doing a training tomorrow night. And I got it out of the box this evening, and I put it on, and I said to my wife, here, give this a try. Let's see what this is like. And I was floored. I just, first of all, like, it took her probably just 10 different tries before we sort of got the right positioning, the right sort of up and in thrust, and the right just, like, go for it mentality to pop the cork out. And I'm really impressed. I'm looking forward to bringing this to my first responder group training tomorrow night and giving it a try and having a whole bunch of different people try it. I was a skeptic just seeing it walking by the booth, and my initial impression is very good now that I've actually tried it. So I'm excited about it.
You know, I heard the same thing from Carissa O'Brien down at EMS Expo, and she was talking about it. And it's one of those things I've never actually tried, and I keep walking past the booth. I guess when I'm down at EMS today, and in just not a couple of weeks here coming up, but I'm going to be down there, and I'm going to have to stop by and check it out in person and check it out. Yep, I see the link there now, actfastmed.com, actfastmed.com. Is the link that guest six popped in the chat room there for us. Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. Greg, I'm interested. You'll have to get some video of that or something and post it. I'd love to share that around on my site too. So make sure you let me know.
Yeah, I think I'll be writing a blog post or two for Everyday EMS Tips and maybe some video. And I'm sure they've got video at their site of the thing in progress too. So, so far, I've got a good impression of it.
And it looks like we have Dr. Anonymous joining us in the chat room. Dr. A, it's great to have you join us. So, boy, this is like 3 months in a row. I'm honored to have the infamous Dr. Anonymous in the chat room. If you haven't listened to Dr. Anonymous's show, you can find it at dranonymous.com. You can also find links to his and a bunch of other great shows over at the ProMed Network. But enough of the chit-chat. Let's jump on in with both feet to tonight's topic. Greg talked about EMS assessment last night at the EMS boot camp, but more than just assessment, there are a lot of issues, I think, surrounding handling pediatric calls in EMS. And I think one of the primary things or problems we face, unless you are working directly with a pediatric facility, is that we just don't see enough pediatric patients in our practice to become comfortable with them. Do you agree with that, Greg?
Well, clearly, yeah, for most of us that are working in sort of your typical response area, that's an issue. You know, there might be some people that, you know, cover a ski hill or an amusement park that maybe get to see, or, you know, a water slide area, maybe they get to see more kids. But in general, I think I want to say I saw a stat at the service I work at. The average age of our patients was like 73 last year. And so, you know, we're seeing lots and lots of old people. The way I did it, the way I got a lot of kid experience, two ways, all through college and then post-college, I worked full-time or seasonally and then full-time at a summer camp. So I spent a lot of time with kids, say 8 to about 14 years old. And certainly there was some injuries, nothing all that severe, but I got to see a lot of like what normal is like, and then kids with minor aches and pains, muscle skeletal trauma, cuts, bruises, and then sickness. And then after becoming an EMT, I worked part-time in an urgent care, and urgent care is all about kids. And so that was a great experience, again, seeing lots and lots of kids that are not having an emergency and are doing relatively okay, but so many that on those occasions where a kid would end up in a urgent care that should have been in the emergency department, you know, you open the door and you're like, oh my gosh, you're in the wrong place. This is an emergency. I can just tell by looking at you from the doorway that, you know, you need more than urgent care. So that's the, you know, two ways that for me, spending a lot of time with kids, and then, you know this as well, becoming a parent is another great way to get kid experience.
Yeah, definitely. I know that when, you know, it comes to seeing kids, and I work with a lot of young EMTs and paramedics that don't have kids, they're just fearful that they're going to do something wrong. You know, they think they're very fragile, and in some cases they are, but kids are also very durable, and they can, you know, if you approach them properly, you can definitely develop a quick rapport with them and have a lot of fun with pediatric patients, you know, and help them through a difficult time. But I think we just don't see enough of them, and it makes a challenge for us. It also causes issues because they are not just a single group. You know, you talk about geriatric patients, there's a common subset of issues that you deal with when you talk about the elderly. You know, there's certain physiological changes that we deal with. But pediatric patients, they run the gamut from neonatal resuscitation needs through the challenges of dealing with infants and toddlers up through school-age children and teenagers, and the various health issues that they face and changes in their physiology and their ability to communicate makes them really not just one group of patients, but maybe four or five groups of patients.
Yeah, you know, that's really true with just those age differences. I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old in the house, and, you know, just the differences between them and how they can communicate, how they respond to new situations, how they handle, like, if something's going wrong or if they fall or run into something. It's remarkably different just with that 2-year age difference. And then, you know, I think the other issue that I guess at some degree you can get this with geriatric patients is, you know, it's not just the actual child that you're caring for. It is also oftentimes a parent or another type of care provider, And then sometimes you even have to help solve, you know, the issue of like, well, if we take one kid and mom to the hospital, what happens to the other kid or kids that are here in the house? We got to help mom figure out that conundrum, that problem before, you know, we take off to the hospital.
Yeah, there's a lot of associated issues and dealing with the fact that that you usually don't just have one child you're dealing with. You have a family. And so you really have a single patient and then loved ones that are much more connected to the well-being of this than of your patient than you might see in any other in any adult patient. Certainly, you might have caregivers or spouses around, but there's certainly a much stronger connection between parents and siblings and a child patient. And you can really run into communication issues with having them wanting to be involved and asking a lot of questions and getting in the way of your assessment, and it becomes just a whole separate issue. Was there any one question that came up when you were talking about assessment challenges last night that you think something you could share with the group today?
Well, you know, we presented a bunch of cases, and one of the cases I put together was an infant that swallowed a marble. And the case was that, okay, this infant was reported to have swallowed a marble. He presents laying on his back. He's playing with the suspended toy, breathing normal, chest rise equal, no apparent distress. You know, is this an emergency or not? And we all agreed, well, this isn't an emergency right now. So here's the, you know, where is the marble, you know? Did he actually swallow a marble? Hard to tell, right? Is it in his esophagus? Is it all the way in his stomach? Or, you know, somebody asked, well, would you look in his mouth? And I think it was Jim shared a story, too, about he had a call where a kid swallowed something that was actually then stuck into the tissue of the oropharynx. And then what do you, you know, do you look around for something? And then if you find something, would you try to pull it out? And, you know, if you'd looked in there and seen the marble, I would think, well, it might make some sense to try to extract it. But, okay, what if that action causes then either to push it into the trachea or to cause the kid to actually swallow it? And so that was kind of an interesting conversation. And I'd be interested in your thoughts there.
Well, I think that, you know, when you're dealing with patients, pediatric patients, you know, getting them to comply with something like letting you look in their mouth is a challenge. I was typing in the chat room talking about physiological issues with pediatric patients and their oxygen their oxygen reserve when compared to an adult. You know, there's a lot of, you know, there's so many things that you deal with when assessing your pediatric patients, and finding out what actually happened and being able to perform a physical assessment of a specific part of their body is a challenge with pediatric patients. Was that what you were asking, Greg?
Well, just I think it was more specific of removing that object, or do you attempt to look in? That was what the interesting conversation was about last
night. And I would look. I mean, I think that there's, you know, visually inspecting a patient is always a good idea. And if you think that they've got something in their airway and you can see it, that's one thing. I mean, you know, we're talking about CPR class last night. You know, we don't do blind finger sweeps, but we certainly can visually inspect. If the kid will open their mouth and let us look, or we're in a position to inspect their posterior oropharynx, definitely we should do so as long as we can do so safely. And if we see something, it'll tell us exactly what's going on. So this certainly, you know, part of our general assessment for any patient should be a focused assessment on the specific area that we suspect is having a problem.
Yeah, we've got some interesting conversations about, you know, the different roles that the parents might take, it looks like in the chat, but also some stuff with just oxygen and a kid's ability to compensate and handle hypoxic events. And, Yeah, one of the reminders that always comes up in any sort of pediatric training is that, you know, it's respiratory problems that are almost always what lead to cardiac arrest in kids, and the importance of recognizing a respiratory emergency and then determining, is it an upper airway problem or a lower airway problem, and then what kind of treatments can I provide, you know, to provide more oxygen, provide assist with ventilations as needed, and then is there anything I can do to reverse or treat that respiratory problem?
Well, and I think we just, you know, one of the challenges that we can all take under our wing and stay up to date on is reviewing the physiologic differences between the different age groups of pediatric patients and adults, and understanding things like the fact that while they physiologically can compensate for a lot of issues that adults can't compensate for, that compensation is not a smooth curve. It's more like a tabletop. And I know that a lot of you have heard this description, but, you know, adults, you'll see that long, slow curve decline as they try to compensate for a shock event. And for pediatric patients, they can look fine, and then suddenly they've crashed. And that's because of that lack of reserve capacity for their oxygen reserve, hypoxic events, anything that causes stress to their system. They can clamp down that vasculature like no adult can, and they can shunt blood flow, and they have a cardiac system that can pump away. But once they run out of that capacity to compensate in their system, they lose the ability to compensate much more quickly than an adult would. And it's more of a shelf that you're falling off of, or a tabletop you're rolling off of, than a long, slow curve decline. And that's one of the challenges, I think, that makes people afraid sometimes as EMS providers of pediatric patients. They wonder and worry about what they're seeing, and can they trust their eyes? And I think we just need to maintain an increased level of suspicion about what is going on when we have an injury event that might be causing internal bleeding, or an airway event. Hopefully you can assess an airway challenge and a choking event and hear the changes in their breath sounds. If not, you know, you need to maintain an index of suspicion and get that kid somewhere where they can get some imaging studies or something, an x-ray, to see if they did indeed swallow something, or did it indeed get stuck. And then we need to definitely keep that in mind. We had a carbon monoxide poisoning event maybe this time last year, and it was a daycare, and there were 10 kids. And, we didn't have enough ambulances to transport all of them. After the fact, when we kind of had a follow-up and a debrief, we were told that we should have called and had a school bus activated to come out to us. It was the middle of the day. There would have been one available, and we could have gotten one to come out and help us with the transport, because they didn't all need to be in a stretcher. They just were all feeling a little sick and needed to be checked out and get their blood drawn and checked for blood gases. And they definitely had been exposed. But all we had was three ambulances for 10 children and not enough car seats for them. So we really, really presented a challenge for us. And, you know, I know there are a couple people in the chat room that are from the state of Maryland, and they know the Maryland protocol says all pediatric patients that qualify for a car seat must ride in a car seat belted into the applicable car seat. We just didn't have the capability to do that. We got one car seat out of the mom who ran the daycare. She had one in her car for her own child, and she was able to let us use that for her kid, but, you know, we didn't have enough. And it just presented a challenge. And I think that, you know, as always, we have to adapt and rise above and make it work somehow, some way.
You know, one of the things I think that kind of presents, and we talked about this as well last night, is that oftentimes because of the anxiety that we might have as care providers about working with kids, that anxiety adds urgency to the call that may or may not be appropriate for the for the kid's actual problem. And so we end up moving faster and not, you know, sort of stopping and pausing. Like, you know, you said with, you've got this group of kids at the daycare, none of them were all that severe. And, but, you know, it could have been just sort of the anxiety of like, well, we've got a mass casualty with kids. We got to just get them to the hospital. Instead of like, okay, somebody's got to step out and sort of be right, the EMS commander, if you will, and say, all right, what are some solutions to move these kids in a way that's safe, because there's not life threats right now, and get them to the hospital. And maybe it delays transport, but, you know, you don't want to mistake, you know, anxiety caused urgency from, you know, an actual emergency. You want to recognize that.
Well, and absolutely true. And you know, we didn't run these patients' lights and sirens to the hospital. We just had this conundrum of how to transport them. And in hindsight, we realize now, and we talked about it, and it was brought up at a training within our company to look at other issues and other resources we had available. And, you know, a school bus would have been an option for some of the older toddler age kids, and that would have pretty much resolved the problem. We could have gone that route. Or you maybe contacted another daycare that had a van with an appropriate number of car seats was another option that came up. And I think that at the time, you know, we're in a rural area. It was kind of a remote setting. And we just wanted to get our units back in service, if nothing else. The patients definitely need to get checked out. But we just didn't go through the whole process and think about the additional resources we have. Another thing I thought about was, you know, talking about reduced reserve capacity for oxygen. Pediatric patients, especially very young ones, are also at increased risk for problems like hyper or hypothermia because of their increased body surface area to mass ratio. And we have to keep that in mind as well, that when we have situations in the wintertime where we're treating these patients, maybe next to a motor vehicle accident, they're well, they haven't been injured in the accident, and they're off to the side waiting to get picked up by the tow truck and taken to wherever with their family. But we need to make sure that we're providing them some form of shelter because they're at increased risk for hypothermia, and we need to keep that in mind, even if they have been checked off and are just bystanders at this point. So something else to keep in mind, and certainly with any injured or ill pediatric patient, that becomes even a bigger issue because we don't want to compound any other issues they have going on by adding hypothermia and all of that cascading series of events to. So I'm looking in the chat room, and we've got a lot of great conversations going on, talking about patients with special needs. And really, we could almost do a whole separate show on children with special needs. But the one thing I always keep in mind and I always stress when I'm handling training for dealing with any kind of patient with special needs is that the caregiver is your lifeline. And I think that ER physicians that I've talked with and worked alongside will all tell you the same thing, that parent is often the most knowledgeable person in the room about that specific illness and that specific patient. And you may never have heard of what's going on with this patient as far as their specific disease pathology, but you can use that parent as a resource. And one of the most important questions you can ask is, can you tell me if what I'm seeing is normal or what is abnormal and what do I need to look for? Because when you have a special needs patient, there may be communication concerns. There also may be abnormalities in their vital signs and physiology that, you know, just like we talk about COPD patients living with changes in their respiratory status that become their norm, we need to know what this patient's norm is as well. And that's the question you always need to ask those parents.
You know, with special needs children, and especially if there's a lot of machinery in the room, I always like to just sort of like narrow my focus in and try not to get distracted by what are the numbers, what's that machine, and just like looking at the child and being like, okay, there's the airway. Okay, how is air getting in? is it, you know, are they breathing just like you or me through their mouth or nose? Are they on, you know, are they intubated, ventilator? Do they have like a tracheostomy? How is air getting in? And then, okay, how are they breathing? Are they breathing on their own, or is the machine breathing for them? And just trying to sort of like really, you know, make sure I got the ABCs figured out. And then, okay, let's look circulation. I feel a radial pulse. What's their skin like? And then turn to that, like just like you're saying, turn to that caregiver and saying, okay, is this, you know, this is what I'm seeing. Is this normal? You know, is he usually or her this pale or this sort of flush? Are they usually breathing this fast or this deeply or this shallowly? Give me some insight here. And then, okay, if we've got to suction this airway, how do you usually do it? And make sure I got the ABCs figured out before I move on to anything like more specific than that. And, you know, most of the time, I'm seeing special needs kids more from a perspective of mom has noticed something's not right, calls doctor, doctor says bring the kid in, and they call by ambulance. And it's not so often that it's an emergency. It's just something's different, and the kid's got to go to the hospital. And you've got time to talk to mom and say, okay, what's, you know, what's what here? What do we got to watch out for? Are you riding with us or not? You know, if we've got a suction or if we've got to adjust this, what do we do? And, you know, take advantage of that resource and also, you know, recognize is it an emergency or not. And a lot of times it's not with those special needs kids that just something's different and they've got to go see their doctor.
You know, the first special needs patient I saw as a paramedic was a great kid, but he had repeated seizure disorder where he just kept, he would have seizures and sometimes they would be uncontrollable and untreatable by medication. Mom would not call us until she had used her third dose of Ativan. And so, you know, at this point, there's nothing I have that can touch it. If she's gone through her treatment options, really it became just a let's get him to the hospital quickly and ride out the seizures we have, protect airway and oxygenation as much as possible. I'd follow protocol, but really at this point he seemed to be refractory to a benzodiazepine treatment and needed to get into the hospital for something more definitive. But I learned through that time frame that you know, it was really a question of going back to basics, even with this special needs patient, back to the ABCs, back to approaching the patient properly, getting and maintaining a good history, and you know, just being watching out for the things that we can treat, whether you're BLS or an ALS provider. And I think that that's something that is very important when we're dealing with pediatric patients is how are we approaching them both mentally, but also how's our physical approach? You know, if they're small, we need to get down to their level. If we're approaching them, we need to do so slowly, especially very young patients who can be easily fearful of strangers. And I'm sure you talked about that yesterday as well, Greg.
Well, you know, we did talk a little bit about that, just the anxiety. I had a streak where every time I would be asked to assess, you know, working at the urgent care, say like a 3 to 4 year old, and it was always females, I'd walk in the room, they'd look at me and they'd vomit. And it's hard not to
take that.
You want
to tell people that, Craig.
Personally, but you're certainly right that just the being ill, being injured, out of their element can cause anxiety in kids. And, you know, sort of I figure what, 0 to 6 months or 0 to 9 months, those kids are used to being just passed around and handled by all sorts of people. And then it's maybe more about a year of age where they start getting a little bit that stranger anxiety. And then after that, you know, I've had some toddlers that are just like very social, very curious, and will strike up a conversation with anybody. and then others that, you know, just hide behind mom the whole time. And, you know, for me, I just try to be straightforward and be calm and explain what I'm doing. And then I look to parents to help. And like one of the things that we talked about yesterday is just, you know, if the kid wants to be held by mom or dad or caregiver or whoever while you're still in the house, say, you know, and there's no like reason not to do that, just let mom hold them. You know, we can check vital signs while mom is holding her child. We can get a history from mom. Most injuries we can look at while mom is still holding the child. And, you know, I know the whole thing about, you know, start at the toes, work towards the injury. And, you know, I guess that makes sense if you want to do a whole head to toe. But, you know, if the kid's falling off their bike and their arm is broken, they know where it hurts. They know it's their arm hurts. And so it's sort of, and mom knows that too. So why are you looking at the toes or the knees or something? You know, I'm going to say, we need to check out your arm. Your arm is hurt. Let's start out here towards your fingers, and I'll move close and I'll talk to you and we'll go slow. And we'll get closer and closer to where it hurts the worst, but I just got to find out exactly where it hurts. And I think just being straightforward and being calm and talking what you're doing about what you're doing and, you know, makes it okay.
Yeah, well, I think toe to head is you make a great point. Even when you do a focused assessment, you can start distally and move proximally to the injury. And that's a great point, starting down at their fingers. And, you know, also distraction's great. Kids love to play with new things that are gadgety. You know, if you can, you know, let them hold the end of your stethoscope or something, you know, make sure you're cleaning your stethoscope between patients, folks. But if you have, you can, you know, let them hold on to the end of the stethoscope. Let them look at your stethoscope. You know, let them look at things around the room. I mean, it's just you've got to approach them carefully. The other thing is that when you treat these patients, you really need to prepare any treatments out of sight of the patient and only bring them into sight when you're ready to actually get to work. And I saw this recently when my youngest had to get some light surgery, minor surgery done. And we opted to go with a general anesthetic because of the location that we're going to have it done. And the challenge was, and she's an 11-year-old girl. She's not particularly squeamish. She's had a lot of health issues. So, you know, she's not afraid of needles per se, but because of what we were looking at, we ended up going to an adult facility, outpatient surgery center to get the procedure done. And not to the children's hospital where we had gotten everything else taken care of. And I'll never make that mistake again, because what ended up happening was we had a very nice nurse anesthetist come in and then the anesthesiologist, and they were going to start the IV. And while they were talking to us, they were very pleasant and very friendly. They just started laying everything out one piece at a time. And she started flinching every time they reached into the tray to pull something out, because she kept being afraid that's when was the needle. No, the next one's the needle. And so this anticipation and fear built up into her until her anxiety level reached a point where she just was done. And we had to go a completely different route to take care of getting her sedated. At our pediatric center, they give them liquid Versed. You know, 20 minutes later, they're so loopy in la-la land, they don't care. And you can't do that specifically in your back of your ambulance, but if you've got to start an IV and this kid's alert enough to be aware of what you're doing, or even a finger stick for a glucose check or whatever it might be, getting those things prepared out of sight and having everything ready to go, and then, you know, even finding your vein and before you even get your IV ready to go, is you know, getting your positioning set up right and then moving quickly can make a whole lot of difference. Not only in their anxiety will go away faster, their trust level of you will increase. You're not going to lie to them. You're going to tell them what you're doing, but you're going to do so right before you actually perform the procedure. And that can make a huge difference in how the whole rest of the call goes.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that story because, you know, you mentioned it. I have read something pretty interesting today that's really got me my wheel spinning in my brain, and that was a study that looked at the differences in pain reports of 4 to 18-year-olds. This would have been after they've been discharged. Some of them went home and were told to take ibuprofen for pain, and others went home and were told to take acetaminophen with codeine for pain. And intuitively, I think a lot of us would assume that, well, codeine's a narcotic, that's going to be more pain control, better pain management. And this study reported that the kids that got ibuprofen experienced less pain with this extremity fracture that they had. And that whole piece just got me to thinking about, are we carrying the right medications on the ambulance and the right administration? And you're talking about liquid Versed. And the whole procedure, you know, for a lot of us, it's causes a lot of anxiety in us to be asked to start an IV on a child. And then this research study from the Annals of Emergency Medicine just really got me thinking about that and, you know, liquid administration of something like ibuprofen on the ambulance, or you mentioned Versed. So it's just a really something that's kind of been on my mind today with kids as well.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, it comes back to we have ambulances that are focused on adult care that, oh yeah, we've got to have a peds bag. And it's, you know, it's a tiny bag to cover a patient group that spans, you know, multiple age groups and need sets of needs. And our, you know, our medications are really, let's face it, our medications are focused on cardiac events. And so what pain relievers we have are not necessarily going to be appropriate for every patient. We should remember that there are a lot of other ways to manage pain, especially in pediatric patients. We need to, first of all, assess pain accurately. And there are a lot of ways to do that. And I'll be sharing a link to a tip I put up on the Medicast page to talk about pediatric pain assessment. I have a link to a page there, and I'll share that with you later. But it certainly is important for us to use all of our tools to assess accurately pediatric pain and then use the variety of tools we have available. And our tools for managing pain are not just medication-based. There is not just a pharmacological answer to that problem. Distraction works great with kids. Laughter works well. If they have a small, you know, a Game Boy or something that they can play a game with and they're capable of doing so, that will manage their pain to some extent and distract them. You go to any pediatric facility and they'll tell you that, you know, TV, video games, and other children are great pain management tools. So keep those things in mind when you have them available and make use of them.
I'm just thinking of an episode of the EMS Educast that we did with the pediatrician, Dr. Mike Pitt, who is also a professional magician. And he talked about just using, in his case, magic tricks, but any sort of distraction or entertainment and how powerful that is for doing an assessment as he works with assessing kids. I'll just throw the link to that episode of the Educast into the talk show for those people, and then I'll send it to you and you can put it in the show notes as well.
That would be fantastic. And you know, talk about two callings that go well together. Pediatrics and magician certainly would make for a definitely a good mix for a patient to look forward to. I know that would be a doctor I'd want to, like, you know, I want to be sick so I can go back and see Dr. Mike if he was a magician.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd wish that.
Well, but, I don't know if I go that route, but I know that right. I know our pediatric dentist is like, his office is like a game room. So he thinks that's just fantastic to have, you know, all the stuff he has access to. Yeah, I got that link, Greg. Great. Thank you. So what else do you think of when, I mean, as far as talking about issues in pediatrics, I mean, we can talk a little bit about equipment, I think, because it seems like, you know, there's lots of specialty equipment made just for pediatric patients, but we have a limited amount of storage space on our units. You know, there are specific pediatric backboards that maintain that airway alignment you need for small children. And, you know, a lot of us have just used padding to get the shoulder blades up a little higher and maintain a good airway alignment. But, you know, you have specific tools to do that. We have specific pediatric immobilization devices, but all these tools and additional pieces of equipment are expensive and take up space. How do we reconcile maintaining a lot of extra equipment for a patient group that we don't see that often?
Well, you could make the same argument, though, about cardiac arrest calls, that in most places, cardiac arrest is 1% of the total call volume. And I've heard, you know, generally we could expect kids to be 10% of our call volume. So, but, you know, your point, though, I think is a good one. And, you know, for me, it's always more, I guess for me, I don't want to question, like, you know, the airway equipment or the immobilization devices. What always sort of gets me is, like, how many stuffed animals do we need to cram into some cabinet? And I think it's a good idea, but we've got this big bag of books now, and we can hand out books. And again, I think it's a terrific idea, but, you know, it's sort of just like one more thing to sort of, oh, I got to shift that to the left. It's like that little game with the little pieces. You got to slide them around to get in order. I got to slide those five stuffed animals out of the way so I can get that other blanket thing. And once I pull that up and out of the way, then I can really get the thing I wanted. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we had a couple of good tips. So one guy said he kept a pack of Pokemon cards or something like that. And, you know, they're relatively inexpensive. It's a one-off deal. You give the kid the pack of cards, they open them up and they can flip through them and read them and look at them. And they have access to having their hands on something that's, you know, first of all, not been handled by anyone else. And it's theirs to take with them as they go. And I find that that's a nice tool. You know, and what a great idea that would be. And I'm going to include that in my list of possible things. Cause you're right. I think you only need one or two stuffed animals, just like you only need, you know, you only need enough things in your unit to handle the next two patients, really, cause you're supposed to be restocking. So if you actually use two stuffed animals, you can get another stuffed animal.
That'd be quite a day, wouldn't it? Oh, to have back-to-back pediatric patients.
Yeah. That were age appropriate for stuffed animals and, you know, everything else. So, and you know, moves us on, you know, talking about age appropriateness, there are that other extreme of pediatric patients, which are the young adult pediatric patients, the tweens and the teenagers who present. You want to be, you need to treat them like adults, but you also have to deal with addressing their parents. And you also have to find ways to communicate with them when the parents aren't immediately present sometimes to ask those difficult questions. Whenever I have a female patient that's old enough, or I think might be old enough, I need to ask the question, you know, do you think you might be pregnant? When did you have your last period? Depending on the type of illness or injury presenting, that might be a question in the assessment, but that might not be answered by the child in front of the parent correctly, or, you know, they might answer falsely because they don't want to talk about what's been going on. And so you need to respect their privacy just like you would any adult patient. and you need to approach your assessment and your history taking from a different direction. So there's a whole nother set of communication and approach issues that present for the kids at the other end of that spectrum.
This opportunity, again, to sort of revisit my early career as an EMT. And, you know, one of the things that I thought I heard somebody say is, oh, female patients, you got to ask them, you know, could they be pregnant? Where are they at their menstrual cycle? And I felt like I was having these odd conversations with female patients where, boy, is that even, I was asking myself, is this really even relevant? And then at some point somebody said like, hey, dope, why don't you just ask that question to patients, female patients that have abdominal pain? That's when it becomes relevant right. for us to ask.
Asking it when it's appropriate to the problem at hand.
Right. And I was like, oh, of course. Thank you. I wish somebody had told me that because I've been asking that awkwardly for people complaining of leg pain, you know. So more in my past.
Hey, listen, you know, we all learn those things along the way. And often it's those assessment questions and procedures that that make us uncomfortable that I think we just kind of develop a way of doing them sometimes right out of school that sometimes we need to adjust our practice and our procedures to be more realistic. And you make a perfect point. When we first learn a lot of these skills, we do a lot of head-to-toe assessments on patients that probably just need a focused assessment. And this is a key point in fact, but when you have a situation going on with any older, you know, adolescent patient, we need to treat them more like adults. And as the problem that we're presented with necessitates it, we need to be willing to ask those difficult questions and be the medical care provider, be that person that's talking, that's being their advocate. And sometimes that means, you know, I take advantage of, you know, telling the parents, why don't you get, you know, get the shoes and coat and stuff while we get your kid out to the ambulance and get them loaded up, and we'll come back and get you situated. That usually gives me about 2 or 3 minutes alone with that patient where I can ask any questions I need to ask out of sight of the parents. You know, have you taken anything tonight? You know, have you been drinking? Whatever the question might be, because you need to ask whatever those private questions are in a position where the kid will actually answer honestly. And sometimes you have to have a system set up so that you can enable yourself that opportunity. And I found that to be one tool is, hey, my partner and I are going to take your son out to the ambulance. Can you grab a coat and maybe a change of clothes in case you're staying a while at the hospital? They'll have something clean to come home in. And that gives you that extra few minutes while you're on the way out to the ambulance to ask questions.
I came up last night with a list of things to ask parents to do, because oftentimes they can go into advanced hover mode and where they just sort of stand and stare and they're not quite sure what to do or where they should be. And then they just end up getting in the way, or they're not actually ready when you're ready to leave. And so, if you're interested, I can share that list of 10 things that I shared last night.
Go for it.
It's not rocket science by any means. But one of the first things I'll do as at the very start of an assessment is if I know this kid's going to the hospital by ambulance, I'll turn to mom or dad and I'll say, somebody needs to go get the car seat out of your car right now and get that going so the car seat's available to strap to the cot when I'm ready to go. So that's number one. Number two, pack the diaper bag. Get that ready to go. Call somebody like dad or mom or grandma or your sister or your brother or babysitter or whoever. Yes, you can go call somebody while we do this. Find childcare. Get going on that because maybe there isn't room for everybody to come with us in the ambulance. Another thing that parents can do is start giving medical history to me, to a first responder, to a police officer, anyone. Gathering medication bottles, they can be singing and soothing. providing comfort. One of the things I noticed assisting with lots and lots of suture repairs of wounds is like everyone wants to look at the wound, right, and the sewing that's happening. And what I was always telling mom or dad is like, don't look at the wound. Look at your child's face. Talk to her. Sing to her. Brush her hair. Hold her hand. Be present with her, not with the wound. Hand-holding, of course. Engage with the child, not the injury. And then oftentimes reminding mom, like, you can take a breath now. I'm really fond of when I have a chance saying to a parent, you did the right thing. You know, you should have called. You did call. Thank you. You did the right thing. And I think a lot of parents, there's a lot of anxiety. You know, some people probably work places where they're like, they find this hard to believe, but there are a lot of parents that really agonize about whether they should call for an ambulance or not. And I like to tell parents that they've done the right thing and that I'm glad they called for us and we're happy to help them. And this is what's happening now and this is what's going to happen next.
That's a great list, Greg. If you have them actually written down, I'd love to share them with the folks in the show notes when the episode goes out this weekend.
You bet, Jamie. I'll send that your way.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we're getting down to the end of the hour, and that means it's time to kind of wrap up the show. And I want to thank everybody for sharing all their thoughts and what's been going on in the chat room. Just been excellent to see everybody's comments and just a lot of great information being shared there. Especially it came up blowing up a rubber glove. And, you know, it's funny. I tried to blow up a rubber glove not too long ago. And unfortunately, the new nitrile gloves don't blow up like the old latex gloves do. So they just don't have the same kind of stretch, which is annoying. So that trick's out the window, I guess. But it certainly is good to see that everybody has developed, I think, based on what I see in the chat room here, a lot of their own style for dealing with pediatric patients. And I think that that's as important as any other patient assessment tool, is developing your own style and comfort level and understanding where you are and then learning from some other things. I love the Pokemon cards trick, you know, for a couple of bucks, just having something like that in the back of the unit is going to make it a lot easier when dealing with those kids that are a little too old for stuffed animals, but would love to have something else to play with and distract them. And what a great idea. So I appreciate that. Greg, any final thoughts for handling pediatric patients or specific issues that you'd like to see addressed in EMS and pediatric care?
Well, I think there's a lot of good training out there, and any of us can benefit from staying current with PALS and then either taking PEP, the Pediatric Education for Pre-Hospital Providers course, or the EPC, the Emergency Pediatric Care course. And one of the things that's unique about the Emergency Pediatric Care course is there's a hybrid version where you can take part of the course online, the didactic portion, and then go into the classroom for the hands-on portion. And it's I helped with the design and production with the committee of subject matter experts that wrote the content for that. And it's really a terrific training program. And I've also heard great things about PEP as well. And I think all of us can benefit from staying current with both if you're an ALS provider with PALS, and then both ALS and BLS providers taking either PEP or EPC or both. So that's my final thought.
Well, thanks, Greg. And now I'm going to have to go check out that EPC training. I've got my PALS recert coming up here in just a couple of weeks, as a matter of fact. And that's going to be, as always, fun. Because I'm a nurse and a paramedic, I use PALS to cover all the bases. But it's always interesting because I'm usually helping the instructor out with the class by halfway through it, because it's usually just a bunch of doctors, nurses, even a couple of dentists have been in classes in the past, and it's just very interesting and very different from the types of classes and training I'm used to in the EMS field. But I'm looking forward to seeing what you've come up with at the with the NAEMT on that emergency pediatric care training class. And that's one I haven't taken. Maybe I need to search one out. That's usually PEP is taught in my area exclusively, and I haven't seen an EPC class in my area. So maybe I'll have to try to search one out.
Yeah, definitely check it out. I just put the link. That EPC course has been up and running for a couple of years now. So, you know, I put the link in the chat, and you can probably use that link to try to find a course near you, but definitely worth checking out.
Yep, and I just picked that link up, and there is a list of course sites, a link on the right-hand side of the front page, so we'll definitely have to check that out. Well, Greg, I want to thank you very much. Can you want to tell everybody where we can find more about you on the...
Sure, Jamie. Thanks for having me. I really enjoy it. People can find me at the blog everydayemstips.com. They can also hear me on the emseducast.com, the podcast by and for EMS educators. But we get lots of students and people just joining that are participating in training or delivering training for that. And then I've also got another podcast that they can find on your ProMed network. It's the Medical Author Chat, where I'm talking to people that have written novels or memoirs, paramedics mostly, about their life on the street and things they've learned along the way. And that's really been a lot of fun. I've got the 10 episodes posted, another four that are lined up for delivery here over the next month. And it's really just been really interesting just to talk to people. And I just interviewed somebody recently that goes way back in the history of EMS, Kate Deniker, who wrote the book Street Sense back in the late in the 80s and the early 90s. And that was just a really interesting conversation. So thanks, Jamie, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you here. Now, Greg, are you going to be coming in for the EMS Today conference in Baltimore in a couple of weeks?
I am not going to be at that conference. I will be out on the road in the next few months, in February at the Wisconsin Technical College Instructors Conference. In March, where am I going in March? March, I'm teaching a class for Wilderness Medical Associates who I teach for. In April, I'm going to Alaska for a conference in Juneau I'm presenting at. And then June, I'll be at the Louisiana EMT Conference and then also at the EMS Administrators Association Conference in San Diego. So I do have some road trips in the months to come.
Okay, well,
but no EMS today.
Well, I'll be at the EMS today, and we'll hold down the fort, and I'll try to put together some stuff so you can chat about it when you see it. But we'll definitely be looking for the rest of you. If any of you out there are going to be coming to Baltimore the beginning of March for EMS Today, I will be down there at least one day, probably two. And roaming around the exhibit hall and maybe setting up some kind of a tweet up. So you want to make sure you're following me on Twitter. Twitter.com/podmedic is how you can find me there. Also the same thing over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic. And of course you can always find everything else over at mediccast.com. And this episode and all the other episodes come out every single Sunday night. So it's there for you when you get moving on Monday morning. You can plug in your MP3 player, sync up the latest episode, and out the door you go with the MedicCast to get you started on the week. Greg, I want to thank you again for helping out and bringing everything together for the EMS boot camp on pediatric assessment. I would urge everybody to, again, check that out. All the other great stuff over at emsbootcamp.com and the other things that Greg and Jim Hoffman put together there.
Right. Thank you so much, Jamie. I really appreciate it.
That's it for me and for Greg for this episode of the MedicCast Live. Greg, we'll see if we can pull this off, just the two of us this time.
All right, let's do it.
All right, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'm here with Greg Fries, and I want to remind all of you to remember Scene Safety
and BSI.